succession number 30132, reel 4.
Things like sport. Does that happen in camp?
In all camps except that one in Tutorano. There was just no place to play it, was the reason. And this is why, as a former transit camp, we were didn't realise how much we were stopped from doing it, because we hadn't had it. About all you could do was walk. There wasn't really any chance to play sport.
So what was it like then to know that you were going to be sent on to somewhere else?
We were merely frustrated. We felt that at any time we should be relieved in southern Italy by a landing. We knew that North Africa would won. We said, rightio, we should get relieved. The next thing, of course, we were told, pack up, you're off, and put aboard train to go north. I was lucky in that I went in a third class compartment, the reason being that I'd walked on a bully beef tin. Once it came to summer, we tried to save our boots, so we went bare feet. And I got caught up. Somebody had opened a bully beef tin with a jagged edge and left it lying about, and I nearly took off a couple of toes. So they whipped me into the lazarette next door and gave me a huge dose of anti-tetanus, so big that my heart was thumping all night, and I realised that I'd had an anti-tet just before I was captured, and this was then too much, really, and if I'd had a weak heart, it would have been a bit bad. Anyway, I enjoyed the whooping in between sheets, and so it was, and I caught crab lice from the dirty sheets. So I was not exactly amused after I just got rid of other lice to find I had crab lice. I asked the orderlies at the hospital who were prisoners, and they said, oh, well, I'll give you, you can shave all your private parts, and we'll give you some blue ointment, which I did, and then they stitched up this as best they could, and then they put me back in the camp. But I could still not walk in comfort with this very bad cut still healing, so I was called a malada, still sick, and therefore, I don't know, I think we were taken by truck instead of having to walk to the station, and about 20 of us were put into a third-class compartment rather than a cattle wagon to go north, and we were rather well-treated compared with the others. We had a little Glaswegian Italian. He'd made the mistake, he'd been brought up in Glasgow in a fish and chip shop, and he made the mistake of going to see his relatives in 1940. And anyone of Italian family was just called up, and that was it. So there he was in the Italian army, and with a broad Glaswegian accent, and very little Italian, and so they put him as a guard. And every time the engine stopped, he sprinted up to the engine and got a billet full of hot water for us to come and make tea, and looked after us very well. So we did work quite well in the trip north. And I had no complaints.
Were you told where you were going to be?
No, merely that you're going to go north. Well, that was obvious. We were right at the south. We knew that. Mm. And we learnt out only... I remember going through San Marino, and they said, pull down the blinds. But we saw the label San Marino. And San Marino was an independent principality, but, of course, it was occupied by the Italians, so what? And it was only about, I think, a couple of thousand acres, the whole thing. So it wouldn't have exactly made any difference. That told us we were in the northeast of Italy and going up the east coast. And next thing we knew, we were changed trains at Udine, which was in the Friuli region, north of Venice, and a few knew enough about their geography or had looked up maps, and they took us to a little camp about 15 miles north of that. And that's where Campo 57 is.
Mm-hmm. Interested to know about this Glaswegian Italian. Where did his allegiances lie, do you think?
Oh, he had no interest in the war. He would have been called up in the British Army if he'd been in Scotland. Mm. But because his parents were Italian and he went to visit them, he crawled up in Italy. So he didn't want a war.
No. How did he treat... He was friendly to you.
Oh, he was friendly as you like to us. And how can we look after you? I can get you hot water and I can see that's all I can do to help you. So he did that every time. Sometimes the water came with a bit of rust in from the engine, but it was hot water. Well, he complained. So you struck these anomalies.
So tell us about Campo 57.
We were only there.
Udine,
yes, Udine. Yes, it was a little place just north of Udine. And I went back to visit it in 1972 while I was doing a tour. And I went to where the camp had been and I couldn't find a trace of it. And I even went to the local army barracks where they were called up for their training, the conscripts, and they had no trace of it. After I came back to Australia, I mentioned that. And they said, why didn't you go to the cemetery? The only place that there's any trace would be then the dozen or so prisoners who died there in hospital. And that would be the only way you'd find them. It was a big camp, and unfortunately had a bad name. They tried to put all the Australians in, dating back from earlier, where they didn't like the Australians, and they put a nasty Carabinieri colonel in charge, who patrolled the camp in pairs looking for trouble. And before I got there, one Australian had got drunk and apparently got aggressive, and they'd given him one warning and then shot him in the belly. They weren't as gentle, we'll say, as the southern Italians. And we were only there 2 weeks before the Italians changed sides.
And the Italians changing side, I understand, you were hoping would mean your release.
That's right. I understand that the instruction from the British Army was all prisoners stand as you are, make no further attempts, because the Italians will release you. But this ignored the reality, which was that there were 3 German divisions between us and any hope. And the German divisions merely kicked out the Italians and took over all establishments and rounded up all camps. Those who were on working parties with 2 or 3 guards, that's where the escapes occurred, and many of them did. As we say, 80 from my battalion at least got through to Switzerland, and somebody is publishing a book in the East right now on those. Those in the camp had no such chance. We woke up one morning to find we had Germans around the camp instead of Italians. And the next thing, we were just put into parties of 50 and told march, and they put the armed guard at every corner and said that if anyone escapes, the other 49 will be killed. And so we didn't argue, and we just marched into a couple of wagons. We loaded aboard, and off we went. And they didn't bother about order, they put the order, not who you were mates with. They just cut off arbitrary, you that way, and that was it. And when we reached a certain point, I don't even know where, they dispatched one train to Austria and one to what had been Czechoslovakia. And we didn't know, and half of our group went off to Austria, and we were the ones who were left, dumped in a big cleft in the mountains for a fortnight. Well, they worked out where they sent us after that. It was 3 weeks, I think we were. And that's where there was nothing. There were transit barracks, and there wasn't a blanket, and there wasn't a palliasse. There was no straw. There were merely very hungry bugs living in the wood. And they fed on us very well.
How did it feel then to be replaced by the Germans, who sound as though they were a lot more efficient?
They were a lot more efficient and a lot more brutal, and they saw us as propaganda. They called us prisoners captured in Italy already. And then as far as the the German public was concerned. This is how much they had defeated all of the people attempting to land in southern, in Sicily or Italy. And so we were given the once-over as though we had just newly captured prisoners. They went through all our things again, gave us, as soon as we arrived at our German camp, so you were taken, given a number according to that camp. And in my, I've got the German records recently, I was sent to one camp 7A in Teschen in Sudetenland, and that's where they gave me my number, and we were given a disc with the statement, if you are caught without that, you can be shot. So I still had my discs, 32723. So you wore that alongside your dead meat discs, and all the time you were a prisoner. That was your only insurance against being shot. If you were without that, then you were a civilian attempting to escape and therefore shot as a spy, or could be. It didn't follow that they would follow it literally, but they could be. So most of us took it. But they registered every man and the ranks and everything else. Some of the Tommies, they showed her, who were fly to it, immediately put up their rank from private to sergeant, whatever, which meant they didn't have to work if they didn't want to, because they, as long as your pay book wasn't too clear, they wouldn't be able to check on it, as long as you didn't call yourself an officer, of course. And there was a fair bit of juggling amongst those who knew, but we didn't, and most of us stuck with our pay book level, and so we were registered and started again as new prisoners.
What was the feeling to be shunted north? To know that you were getting further and further away from Italy, getting closer to Germany.
Well, one more break. We said, well, all the time we were in the Middle East, we went north into cold and rain and snow every winter, and we went south into the desert every summer. Well, now that it's getting cold again, they're sending us north from Italy. It can't be cold enough. They send us to ruddy Germany. That was our general thought, and it'll merely take another year. We all thought the same. A year longer from before Italy collapses, now we thought a year longer before Germany collapses. So put up, get wait for another year.
What were the conditions in the cattle trucks on the way to?
We had one guard at the back of our truck. He just made a hole in the roof and looked down and occasionally spat at people, and anyone that attempted to do anything out of line, he threatened. So we didn't do any escapes from our cattle truck. From further along where there was no guard looking in, a couple of them forced a hole in the wood and jumped out and managed to escape. One or two actually were on the loose for quite a while, and a couple did escape into Yugoslavia and join the partisans, but not from our 50. We had no hope. Unfortunately, we were the last wagon, I think, of that particular train, with the guard sitting up in the roof looking in. So we sat. We didn't have much job.
Mm. You were on your way to the Sudetenland in this particular instance?
We didn't know at that point. All we knew was that we stopped, and then we looked up, and there was the mountains on either side, and we were in this narrow valley with a railway running through. And we were there for a couple of weeks, and then they led us on another train. And the next thing was when we were in Sudetenland, and we were marched to Camp 7A. We were told it was 7A, and that's when they lined us up and registered us and gave us our discs. And we found it was a hungry camp, no Red Cross. I said, working parties will be accepted. We went out in working parties. In a hungry camp meant no Red Cross.
So to work meant that you would get more food? You
know? Oh, yes. They had a ration scale pretty strict, and they had 1,500 for calories per day for non-workers, 1,800 for light workers, and I think 2,100 or something like it for miners, for example. Some worked down the mines, but that was not exactly popular. But at least they attempted to give more food for it.
Mm. How did this differentiate the prisoners from one another again?
We didn't know where we were going. We merely said there's a working party, and we must have a certain number of NCOs. A party of 370 of us was sent out from this 7A, and we were given a little spot near the old Polish border. And we turned out that this had been occupied by Jews. We only learned that 3 months later. We found that a series of huts, each with about 20 or 30 in, and I was a hut commander for one, and we had all in the others. And then we were allocated groups. We need a group for here, and off you go. A group for there, off you go. And I only had an unteroffizier, and about, that's a corporal, and about 15 other ranks for a guard. But the Germans then gave more responsibility, including the power of life and death, to a corporal than we give to a captain. And he had killed at least one prisoner for disobedience. He didn't get out of bed when he was told. So you didn't disagree.
Mm.
I watched him play Russian roulette with a Russian prisoner who dared to come up and take our leavings, which weren't exactly that good. And so we made him dance while he fired his revolver. He was automatic. And, by his feet. Made him run away. Poor bloke could scarcely stand up from starvation. But then that's when we saw the difference with the Russians.
Mm. I was wondering, those people that chose to work, those people that didn't work, or those people that couldn't work, how did that then differentiate the soldiers that were getting more rations? How did it sort of cause problems, possibly?
I don't know. I never went back to 7A to find out. I was only there for a few days, mm-hmm. and I went out. And when we were sent back, we found that the headquarters we were sent back to was 8B, Lambsdorff, number 344, which was a camp that had been operating in World War One and rebuilt as after World War One and now reused in World War Two. So it was long established and utterly different. So I can't really say what happened to 7A thereafter.
Mm. So this was 344?
344.
Lambsdorff
camp. That's right. Mm. It was called 8B and then they changed the number to 344.
I've got 8A here.
Well, no, it was 8B. Yeah. There's a big difference. 7A was where we first arrived. And then 8B was where we were sent back to when I finished that working part.
Mm. How long were you there for?
I would say it'd be about 2 months. Mm. It would have been the months of December and January. I remember being there at Christmas, and John the Bastard, I never knew him by any other name, that unteroffizier, actually gave us a 50-gallon keg of beer, 1.5%. Since it was German winter, then it wasn't very thrilling, and most of it was poured out. That's what we thought of it. It was described very correctly in rude terms. His idea of giving us a Christmas bonus, I think. We were called out later on that Christmas day to unload two wagon loads of bricks. So there were about 80% of those got broken in the unloading. We were a little bit cross on it.
You were to stay in Stalag between February 44 and January 45.
That was Stalag 8B, renamed 44 Lambsdorff, which was very different.
Tell us about the average day there.
Well, if there wasn't an urgent call out, there would be a rouse, and the count, the appel, every morning, usually about 7. And you line up for the appel, and they did a count and checked on who was in the sick list, and for each hut. And they just came where previously they had people in the German section between each pair of barracks. By the time we got there, they used to come in instead from the outside. And provided the appel was okay, then off. And then there would be call up for a soup and call up for everything else that was going on. But the camp was usually NCOs plus those other ranks, other privates, between working party. So it was largely corporals and sergeants. And when I used my rank to avoid going down a mine, that's how I got sent back. I said, I'm not going down a mine. John said, I've got to get a group for mines. He said, these are the people I've drawn out of a hat. And he drew all hut commanders, because we were the ones who had made protests about a few conditions. And we put on sufficient show that he said, I'll do another draw. So we said, well, we won't survive a second draw. So that's when I used my rank and went back to camp. And people didn't like going down the mines. They were no longer shoring up the mines. And I feel sorry for those who did, but I wasn't going to be silly enough to go down because of that. And we quite expected to go to 7A, but instead of that, we were sent back to Lansdorf, or sent on to Lansdorf. And then I was allocated to a different group, where they were well organised, three-level bunks that had been there since 1940, a lot of British prisoners that had been taken in the fall of France, and they were the ones who were starting to get very edgy and getting wire happy, and they tended to have a higher rate of people going round the bend there. They had to have a few psychologists for them. There were quite a big hospital, a very big camp. It was servicing roughly 10,000 people in six compounds around, plus 50,000 out working, with the 50,000 coming in if that job's finished or a person was sick, and then going out perhaps on another allocation, that sort of thing.
Mm. How did the Australians get along with the Tommies?
No problem. We were issued with British battle dress and not treated any different. And we're all mixed up on our table of 12. I had, I think, four South Africans, two Tommies, two Australians. I can't remember who the others were. Just took them as they came.
What was the level of bonding that occurred?
A few individuals, but if you get to an odd Aussie, much more so. I had one fellow, for example, from my unit that I didn't know before, and he was on the loose in Italy until somebody, a fascist, dubbed him in 4 months later, maybe even 6 months. So he came straight over without anything except what he stood up in into the camp. In the meantime, I'd received a couple of parcels from home. I was able to help him. He only died 2 years ago, and he just lived down, or his wife, widow, lived down the road. And I hadn't seen him for 40 years when I saw he died. But that was a fair example. Because he was my unit, I had two shirts, he had none, I gave him one, that sort of thing. Mm. But a good bonding with your own mates. But with the others, you merely rubbed along. I had a bit of bother with one or two South Africans. I didn't like them particularly, but that's par for the course.
I'm interested to know what the sort of dangers can be getting too close to other prisoners. Is it the same as the bond that can almost be too dangerous to get too close to another soldier because you may be killed? Is it a similar sort of thing in camp, or is...
No, not really. Didn't find any problem like that. You're unlikely to. You got to know people a bit. Being a big camp, we had football, that is soccer, played all the year round. They made an attempt at rugby union using the same small ground. They played international cricket in the same small ground when the snow was off the ground, of course. And then we had a lot of Red Cross and YMCA material, and they had camp concerts and a fairly organised setup and a school.
Tell us about those camp concerts. What sorts of things would take place?
Well, they put on plays, and they made quite a big effort, and they'd always put on a couple of women, quote, and they were highly regarded, and of course much joking about those. And the only time we ever saw German Fraulein's was when they paraded the cast through the camp ready for the next show, and the Fraulein's New and Matty Jacobit. They were usually employed as censors outside the camp, and we wouldn't see them otherwise at all. In fact, they were only from a distance even then.
Who was involved in the plays and concerts?
Largely it tended to be British troops. For some reason they had a big music hall background, a lot of them, and they were very good at starting plays. We had one or two Australians, but the Poms were well ahead in that particular respect, and I can give them all the credit for organising plays and activities of that nature. It seemed to be part of their background more than ours.
How did it help to boost morale?
Well, quite a lot. You had something to do to prepare for it, if you were acting in it, or if not, your audience. At one stage, towards the end of the war, the Germans issued an edict, this would be in about November 44, that no more than two people can be on the stage at once. This was, of course, to cut down the manpower requirements in their own entertainment. The commandant tried to force it on prisoners, and for a couple of weeks we were forced to try and put on plays limited to two people. Then they pointed out that it was quite ridiculous in prison camp, and he wiped that rule, which was not really intended for a prison situation.
How did you keep yourselves abreast of what was going on outside?
We had unseen wireless sets. I never saw one, but they managed to make wireless sets and get the BBC. We got the German news, no trouble, and the German news was available. And one of the people on my hut, come to think of it, on my table, was an ex-German Jew who was enlisted as a British Palestinian. They treated him as a Britisher, and he kept himself as a British soldier. And he, of course, never let on that he was fluent in German, but he translated the German newspapers and the German news, radio news, and he had on the wall, and he used to put on two fronts in the map, and one of them in blue was as stated by the German, in red is shown by BBC, and moved that every time before a guard came in to make sure that we couldn't ever admit that there was a big gap between the two. So we got the BBC news when it was red, and hut commanders were always appointed from the man, l'homme de confiance, would appoint a warrant officer in charge of each hut. In Germany, it was done strictly.
Do you recall any specific points of news that you remember
the fall,
being of significance?
Oh, the fall of Stalingrad. That, as far as the one of the Germans in the work party that I went out to, I remember him saying, my father told me we lost the war in 1917, as soon as the Americans declared. And he said, my father is still alive, and as soon as he heard of Stalingrad, he said, son, we've lost this one too. And the Germans knew it. Stalingrad was the turning point, as far as they were concerned.
What did that mean for you as prisoners?
Well, it meant all. Just a matter of how can you stay alive long enough? You must get out.
Were you still living day to day?
Up to a point, but we were looking, the fact of now, is it 6 months or a year or what? That's all. We knew we were going to win. We had hope, if you like, early on. We had confidence by 44 that it would happen, if we could be with it.